Hello and welcome to Dealcast, the M&A podcast. I'm Juliana Needham. Today we're diving into one of the most significant transformations in private markets, the evolution of the secondaries market. What was once a small opportunistic solution for LP liquidity, secondaries have now grown over five decades into a fully fledged capital market, one that surpassed $220 billion in deal volumes in 2025. In this episode, Merger Markets Funds editor Tom Kane is joined by two guests who we're very happy to have with us on the podcast, Jeff Hammer and Paul Sanabria, who are managing directors with the Private Capital Advisory Group at Moelis & Company, where they help to lead the firm's global secondaries practice. In this conversation, you'll learn about how the market has moved from LP-driven trades in the 1970s and 80s to GP-led restructurings in the 2010s and on to today's GP-led 2.0 world. And with more capital pouring in, we'll hear their thoughts on what the next 10 years might hold.
Hi, Jeff. Hi, Paul. Great to have you on the show today. Welcome to Dealcast.
Hi, Tom. Great to be here.
Well, fantastic. It really has been a remarkable transformation. So you think about secondaries at the beginning, which we'll get into. It was certainly opportunistic. It was certainly a niche area of the market. Today, it's over 200 billion. So it's been, you know, quite a remarkable story. One thing I love about secondaries is just how collegiate it is. You know, you meet people that have known each other for years, for decades. They've been on that journey together. I think it's a really good opportunity for us today to get into that a little bit because you guys are in that situation. You've been business partners, colleagues, friends for over two decades. So before we start talking about secondaries, I'd just like to find a bit more about how your journey started. So how did you first get to know each other and how did you together get into secondaries back in the day?
Yeah, that's great, Tom. Well, great to be with you. I'm embarrassed to say, or can we say it was by accident? It's a little back to the future. Jeff and I, over 25 years ago, had this idea of democratizing the private markets and started what today has been quite common and started a business where we were almost a mutual fund company. Our intentions were to be a mutual fund company for the private markets. And in order to do that, we decided that there needed to be a level of transparency on what people were investing in. And so we set up an arrangement with AIG to effectively buy assets or have an option to buy assets off of their balance sheet. And to be honest with you, Tom, I'm not even sure it was called secondaries at the time. And we certainly didn't know we were doing a secondary transaction. But we did that. And I think we became the first 34 Act fund that was out there way before the emergence of these now evergreen funds. And that was really our introduction to secondaries. And as you said, it's been a 25-year journey that Jeff and I have been on together with great growth, great innovation, and really permanence and importance of secondaries in the overall capital markets. So we're super excited. One other thing I'll add is Jeff and I have this odd background where we've been both investors and advisors twice, which is pretty unusual, particularly at the senior level where we've started two investment businesses, one investing in LP interests and then one investing in GP leads, and also two advisory businesses, both at Houlihan Lokey, where we ran the secondary advisory business. And then now here, we've joined Matt Wesley to help build out the private capital advisory business here at Moelis. So it's been quite a journey, and Jeff and I have been on it together. And as you said, sometimes longer than marriages, 25 years.
Yeah, so I guess you're saying you are decades ahead of the curve when it comes to not only secondaries, but private wealth. Let's talk about what the market looks like back then and maybe even before. There are I've heard different versions of when secondaries started. Sometimes people get into quite hot debates about that. But Jeff, when would you say the secondaries market officially began or non-officially?
Yeah, it's interesting. As long as we've been in the secondary markets, its beginning actually predates us. And I would say, just as an aside to Paul's earlier comments, it's been a fantastic run to basically work with your best friend if you can make that happen. 30 years is a long time. We met in 1988. So I'll leave everyone else to do the math. But from what I can tell, the secondary market was really initiated by Dayton Carr in 1979. And when he purchased a portfolio of LP interests from Thomas Watson, he went on to form Venture Capital Fund of America, today known as VCFA. And VCFA, from what I can tell, raised the first secondary fund in 1984 with $6 million. $6 million. Pretty small amount of money, pretty small market at the time. Interestingly, one of the first investors in that fund was a gentleman who's still in the market today and still very prominent, Jeremy Collar. Obviously, Collar Capital was recently acquired by EQT. So there's a through line from that first fund in 1984 to where we are today in 2026. Jeremy Collar worked with a gentleman by the name of Arnaud Isnard. And then the two of them split, Collar forming Collar Capital, which, as we mentioned, was purchased by EQT recently. And Arnaud Isnard formed Arcus Group, which was based in Paris. Other notable firms that were starting in those early days were Landmark, today owned by Ares, founded in 1989. Lexington, which broke away from Landmark, founded in 1994. There's an entity that no longer exists, but was very prominent, Paul Capital, founded in 1991. Pomona Capital in 1994, and Willeridge Partners in 1995. But no one at the time would have known these names. These were really small entities that were purchasing partnerships interests at the very beginning of the private markets. Who would have known that they and others would have grown to the prominence where we are today?
Yes, it's really interesting to hear, you know, some of those names are, you know, household names now in not just secondaries, but, you know, broader private markets and financial markets. And obviously you mentioned Collar being acquired by EQT, you know, very recently. So we cast back to then, it was opportunistic. It started to evolve over time, what we'd call a real business, I guess. So how did it get there? I mean, what problems was it trying to solve initially, Paul? And how did it evolve into what was a bona fide market?
Sure. I mean, like a lot of markets or businesses or opportunities are created through sometimes regulation. You know, sometimes shocks or dislocations in the systems, and sometimes just good old fashioned innovation. And I think in our market that all happened and probably all sort of came galvanized in and around the year 2000, maybe 1999 to 2021. And it was really, and even before that, I should say, when the ERISA changes took place in the 70s and 80s, allowing institutions to move from, you know, fixed income to public equities and eventually onto the private markets, you suddenly had a participation with these institutions through these limited partnership interests. That was the method that by which they were going to take exposure. And the shock to the system, the first shock to the system was the dot-com or the tech crash, right? Because suddenly you had a situation where you had institutions at reasonable levels participating in the markets, and yet you had a shock to the system, public markets go down, you had the first denominator effect. Way back when suddenly institutions said, oh my God, I'm over allocated to this private market. So by the way, how do I create liquidity? I can't just go to a market and sell it. And innovation really came in because some of those names that Jeff just described were there. They were there for the taking to help solve the use case, which is I need to rebalance my portfolio or do something with my portfolio, maybe get some liquidity. And that's really where it started. Now, just to put that in perspective, all of those names that Jeff just described, you know, at the time, I think there was one fund over $1 billion during the dot-com crash. You know, today, I think there's 40 franchises with their last fund at $1 billion, and the largest fund ever raised in the market overall has been a secondaries fund with Ardian's $30 billion fund. So we went from this very beginning where the use case is I've got an issue in my portfolio to kind of where we are today, where that construct of needing liquidity is just regular way, certainly within the LP market, where we've had this tremendous buildup in supply and demand, supply meaning lots of institutions continuing to participate in the private markets through LP interests, and demand because you've just had these dedicated secondary funds come in to capture, you know, that opportunity and to play that role from a counterparty perspective. And so that's really how the LP market exploded. And of course, the biggest innovation in the market overall, and we're going to talk about, is a fundamentally different use case, which is the GP-led market, which went and to address a different problem. And of course, that's exploded because that's now roughly 50% of the market. So I've just sort of taken 25 years and sort of boiled it down to it, its essence. But that's really how a market has evolved in secondaries.
I'm glad you mentioned GP-led. Obviously, a lot of the growth that we've seen in the last 2-3 years has been on the GP-led side. When did that start? It was back in the 2010s, right? So what were the first GP-led deals that we saw? They were quite different to what we're seeing now, right?
What's interesting, across the decade of the 2010s, the GP market came about. Coming into 2010 was the detritus of the great financial crisis, and that distorted financial markets and fundraising, not just for the acute period of crisis in 2008, but also for the 3 to 4 years afterward. And what you saw on the one hand were hedge funds who had put up gates, who were monetizing assets and taking care of business because they had to. But you also had private equity funds that were stalled. They had been around in some cases for decades, in some cases less, but they had fundraising issues. So bankers and secondary market investors looked at these situations and said, how can we spring good assets that are locked up in funds and move them into a structure that allows everyone to move forward and creates win-win-wins for everybody? And in those early days, I would say 2010 to 2015, there was a lot of experimentation going on. We identify the first modern day GP-led transaction. There is some controversy about it. Some folks will go back and say they've done GP-led transactions since the beginning of time. But the first modern day one was, we think, in 2013, when Berman Capital ultimately did a deal to sell 4 portfolio assets to CPPIB. And Berman Capital continued to manage the assets. And we see that $1 billion transaction as the very first modern day continuation vehicle. The market really started to go mainstream, I would say, after 2015. You know, there was some period of adjustment between 2015 and 2017. But then if you were to look at the growth of the market from 2018 until today, it's really been up and to the right.
You see, you mentioned, obviously, win-win-win. But initially, it was to solve problems, restructuring, so to speak. It then transitioned to now we hear about trophy assets. So these are assets that GPs want to hang on to, they want to grow. So what happened in the market to turbocharge it to that stage where it suddenly this was a solution for those assets that GPs wanted to retain rather than they needed some kind of a solution for?
Yeah, I think there was a transition. Jeff was very generous at the beginning, saying they were good managers out there that were looking for a solution. Truth be told, post GFC, there were some challenged platforms, some challenged assets. And you are right, Tom. The world often called those transactions recapitalizations, restructurings, and the dreaded zombie fund concept really came about.
Right.
And those were the early applications of the GP-led technology, but it wasn't called GP-led, but it really was trying to solve that issue that Jeff described, fundraising issue, liquidity for LPs, creating economics for the GPs. But they did kind of look like a little bit like recapitalizations and restructurings. And as Jeff said, the technology was honed over time, and it really was around 15, 16, 17, where you started to see better managers say, this is really interesting. It was very instructive for both managers as well as secondary players to see what was going on in some of those challenged situations. And the better managers with the better assets suddenly said, hey, maybe the secondary market can help with a different issue. And the issue really that they were trying to address, in many respects, some people call it midlife liquidity. You know, we have a great asset. We believe we're the best owner for that asset. We want to extend the duration in this very unnatural 10-year time frame that funds operate into. So how do we do that? Because most LPs, rightfully so, don't love, you know, moving an asset from one fund kind of to the next. And so what really created the explosion, again, back to this concept of, you know, regulation, dislocation or innovation, was really COVID. Because what you had is you had a different crisis where crises tend to lead in the capital markets to, you know, lower M&A volumes and lower IPO marketplace and tougher to recapitalize companies. You had a situation where you had all of these companies that had been matured, really good companies, but there was no market for it. They couldn't sell it in an M&A and through an IPO in a regular way. So the secondary fund market came and essentially said, we can solve your problem. We will be the counterparty to these transactions, and we will effectively underwrite, price, and help structure what is now today the modern day GP-led. You hear things like trophy assets. At the time, it really was trophy assets, the best assets that these managers had that simply couldn't sell in a regular way. And the GP-led solution was there to create interim liquidity, an alternative exit path than the traditional M&A IPO recapitalization market.
Yeah, and I'd just like to jump in, Tom, quickly to characterize the beginning of the secondary market was very opportunistic. We look back and we say those were a series of trades. Every time there was a financial crisis, financial institutions would typically cough up assets, and they could be assets in which they invested directly or they could be through funds. The question was, when was it going to become a business? When did it become a business? And beyond a shadow of a doubt, in the middle of the 2010s, after the great financial crisis, it became a business. All different types of investors use the market for portfolio management reasons. And to Paul's point, and I was being a little generous before, what we called these stalled funds really were called zombie funds. It was perceived that they didn't have a future. And the secondary market, being very solution-oriented, basically iterated until they came up with a future. And that future was so interesting that in our view, the secondary market became a full-on capital market, a full-on market where sponsors and investors could go to and could craft the transactions. It was well-funded enough. And it wasn't too long before, back to your point, Tom, sponsors said, hey, I've always wanted, as Paul said, hang on to these assets for longer because these are my best assets. These are my trophy assets. And the secondary market created that solution because it was a rich enough capital market to do that.
It's fascinating to me how, looking back at the history, how you've described it, the market has evolved and you've got these times of great shock. Obviously, you mentioned the dot-com crash, the financial crisis, COVID. It seems the market's then taken on another leap to get to that next level. And obviously, trophy asset brings us to today. We hear a lot about trophy assets. What I'm interested in is how much of that is PR versus, this really is a trophy asset. We see a lot recently, for example, companies that you mentioned, obviously, the secondary market provides solutions. We do see a lot of assets that sponsors first maybe look at some kind of an M&A solution for. Maybe it's not a full-on process that doesn't get to the finish line. It might be just an evaluation check. But we do see a lot of those assets coming into the secondary market. So could those be defined as trophy assets as well? I mean, what is a trophy asset, I guess?
I think that's an old term, candidly. I think the concept of a trophy asset was an excellent way to galvanize the market, particularly post-COVID, because these truly were trophy assets, leaders in their industry. I think that as our market has innovated, the concept of trophy asset is a little bit faded to the background. And the question is, what are the types of assets or what are the types of dynamics that make a GP-led viable? There's no doubt about it that these are better assets. These are typically the best asset or best assets within a fund. But the characteristics of a deal, whether it's an M&A deal or in our case, a GP-led deal or a continuation vehicle, I think it's those characteristics that are more important than the concept or the moniker of a trophy asset. And it's really about, having a fundamentally a good asset. A good asset is typically defined by, yes, a market leader, but doesn't necessarily need to be number one. It needs to be a growth asset because the return profile for GP leds is much higher than LP leds. So typically you need to be able to grow into that return. You have to have a terrific sponsor who's going to be the steward of that capital. The reason it's called a continuation vehicle, it's the manager continuing to manage that. It needs to be priced well, which means the mark that they're holding it up, mark to market, needs to be appropriate at the time in which you're pricing it. And lastly, there needs to be alignment, tremendous alignment. It's one of the structural principles in our business is terrific alignment between the sponsor who's going to sit alongside this new capital that's coming in the form of rolled carry, rolled GP commit, and oftentimes a cross fund. So in summary, I don't think the trophy asset concept, I think it's too narrow in the context of this tremendous marketplace that's been created, because and it really is a hallmark of our industry where we've been able to innovate to come up with that as opposed to just narrowly looking for it. Always has to be a quote trophy asset. That's my personal view.
I would tack on, Paul is exactly right. And I would add to it that the market, investor market, has widened and segmented into folks who really want those so-called trophy assets versus folks who want more value-oriented assets and are willing to do a little more work. And how do you arbitrate that? It's by price. But as the market has broadened for capital sources and investors, you now see many different types of assets, not only trophy assets, welcomed in the secondary market.
So I guess then there's a sense of the market, you know, maybe not coming full circle, but certainly evolving into something that there's more comprehensive. It's providing solutions to a range of companies. I guess a lot of that is facilitated as well by the wave of capital that is coming in. We've seen a deluge coming in really from pockets. I think Jeff obviously mentioned some of these, you know, multi-billion funds are being raised. We're also seeing new entrants coming in, you know, direct sponsors, for example. We're seeing, you know, many different types of investors coming in. So let's kind of dig in a little bit to where that's coming from and how it's reshaping the market. Jeff, what are you seeing, Jeff, on that side?
Yeah, I mean, the market is in a virtuous circle upward. A market is two-handed. You need supply, you need demand. And both sides of the market are growing. I don't know if we mentioned it on this call yet, but estimates for 2025 full-year transaction volume is somewhere between $226 billion and $240 billion, and the studies are still coming out. That compares to last year, 2024's full-year volume of around $165 billion. Quite a step function. And if you go back over time, and you look at 2000, total market volume was $2 billion. So we are 100 times larger 25 years later. You can look at the same metrics 10 years ago. We're probably 10 times larger than we were 10 years ago. So we are in this virtuous circle. And the reason that that's occurring, Tom, there's a very large cohort of private companies within funds that have been owned for a while, and sponsors wanting to find ways to produce DPI or distribution to paid in capital. The problem was not the supply of those companies. The issue, the constraint on the market had always been the amount of capital available to purchase into those companies. One of the trends that we've seen recently, as you mentioned, direct sponsors, names like Leonard Green, Warburg Pincus, New Mountain Capital, are raising money, which for them is really a differentiated offering because they are agreeing to go into these CV transactions as passive capital. I want to underscore that. These are folks who for a long time held the joystick, figured out what they would do, and now they're putting capital alongside other sponsors, their peers, elsewhere. That is a major innovation and has opened up a whole new fundraising opportunity. There are also asset managers going into the market, like Blue Owl. There are all sorts of sovereign wealth funds who are standing up teams and allocating capital to teams that are dedicated on CVs. So the market sources of capital are broadening dramatically as we speak. It seems like every couple of weeks, there's another announcement of some entity that's coming into the market and targeting GP-led transactions, primarily continuation vehicles.
And the only one, just to add to that, I think Jeff did a good job there, you know, direct sponsors, LPs that are getting in the business, themselves standing up teams, larger funds within the traditional secondaries, dedicated funds away from their core LP purchasing fund. And the only last one that Jeff didn't describe was the evergreen, the emergence of the evergreen. Again, going back to the future, back to where we were 25 years ago, that source of capital, the ability to bring high net worth or ultra high net worth money into these evergreen vehicles, which remember, you know, this cash coming in has to be deployed very quickly. Otherwise, you have tremendous cash drag, naturally leads them to lead with secondaries as a large portion of their allocation, whether it be a fund that's doing primaries, co-investments in secondaries or dedicated secondaries. They are using the secondary market, or they seek secondary transactions to quickly deploy their capital. So that's another whole source of capital. And if I told you the numbers, they're quite extraordinary, both in terms of the number of evergreen funds that exist out there, but also the amount of capital that they're raising on a monthly basis. We're seeing the check sizes from these evergreen funds go up just meaningfully in terms of individual deals. So we are awash in capital, which is good. Although with that being said, some might say we still don't have enough capital relative to the opportunity set, but there's certainly more capital coming in. So the supply demand continues to eke up, as Jeff said.
So you mentioned undercapitalization. We've obviously seen, you know, a lot of capital pouring in, but is it really enough? I've heard estimates that maybe a half of single asset continuation vehicles don't get done or could get done. So is this new capital coming in, you know, really moving the needle? Leonard Green had a fantastic fundraising, $3.6 billion, but it's still, you know, very much kind of a drop in the ocean compared to the potential size of the market with these combined. So, I mean, what are your views on that?
Yeah, let me jump in on that one, Tom. First off, your implication is that most of these deals should get done. You know, there are so many different use cases that we have seen. When we were at Manulife, we saw over 800 deals in the 5+ years that we've sat as investors at Manulife. And the variety of the quality of the individual deals was extreme. So there is a natural attrition rate that some deals that come to market probably shouldn't be funded. That's point one. So, and if you speak to our colleagues over in M&A, you will see there's always a failure rate. It oscillates in different levels between in a bad market versus a good market, but you really never get 100% completion. And if you talk to some of the skilled bankers in the space, they are achieving 70+ completion rates, some cases even 90% on the deals they bring to market. So the capital is there, it will be there. The second point is that many of the announcements that are made by direct sponsors and others are announcements. They now have to go out and raise money. So the Leonard Green announcement of having raised $3.6 billion, and similarly, there was a Painswick announcement, Painswick's affiliated with AIA for something like $1.5 billion, they now have the capital to invest. But many of the other firms are still out there either making seed investments and advancing to fundraising. So all the announcements doesn't necessarily correlate to capital being in place. So I would highlight those two, that one, there's always going to be a failure rate. And number two, that there is more money being formed and heading towards the market, which will begin to address what Paul referred to as a capital deficit.
Now, that's a good point about the failure rate, but I guess the sheer demand for transactions points to, you know, further growth, right? So if we look ahead to 2035, how do you think secondaries develops in that time frame?
Well, 35 is a long time, so let me cut that in half and say 30, because I have a hard time knowing what's going to happen next year, let alone 10 years from now.
You and I will still be doing deals in 2035, right?
Yeah, exactly. The secondary market transaction volume has effectively grown at 20% plus over the course of the last dozen years. All the supply and demand dynamics that Jeff and I have been talking about, you could cut that in half and still be a $500 billion transaction volume in 5 years. $500 billion. By the way, for the last 3 years, do you know the secondary market has been larger than the IPO market in terms of transaction volume? So, we are only going to go up and to the right because of the use cases, both on the LP side. We spent a lot of time on the GP side, but both of them are going up harmoniously, and because of the new capital that's coming into the marketplace. So we can talk about some of the elements of or components of that growth. But for me personally, I see this marching towards a $500 billion plus market over the course of the next 5 years. And to Jeff's point, supply and demand works its way out. You could look at the math and say we have roughly 1.5 to 2, depending on whose math you're looking at, in terms of coverage of amount of available capital over the next 12 months for the amount of expected deals for next year. And by the way, that's lower. These are why people say there's capital deficits, because it's lower than the traditional ratio between private equity funds, the amount of capital with the volume there. But in our market with, you know, new capital coming on board, I agree with Jeff, the right deals get done. If you have a good deal, remember the characteristics that I described before just in the GP-led world? If you have those characteristics, or candidly, if you have most of those characteristics, your deal will get done. But there are deals that just won't get done, and that's not a function of the market. That's just, it's not set up for success.
And I would add, Tom, if I may, that the secondary market is a creative market. It's been wonderful to spend a career in it, because if you can imagine a deal getting done, and you can then make your case to a capital provider, everyone is open to that. So 5-10 years from now, there are going to be other types of transactions, other folks who are coming into the market that we didn't see coming. And, you know, I've gone from being cautious. There's Jan Robard, who runs Dawson. very famously made large predictions some years ago. And for the most part, his predictions have come true. And while many of us were somewhat skeptical about the growth, he was right. And the growth moves forward. And so I think Paul's absolutely right. And then in 5 years, we could see a $500 billion market. And in 10 years, it could be a $1 trillion market, because the private markets have grown so substantially. And people in partnerships, institutions in partnerships, need liquidity just for a variety of reasons. That's the fundamental driver of why the secondary market exists and why it's growing.
And we've spent so much time talking, Tom, about private equity. Let's not forget that it's not just private equity. This market has grown in other areas: infrastructure, real estate, private credit, technology. Yeah. All of those markets, the importance of private markets within the context of those asset classes, more money going into them. That's, again, that's the supply side. The more money that goes into those, particularly in closed-end fund format, that becomes the collateral, the fodder for future secondary deals. Secondary is just a derivative of the primary market. So you've got tremendous growth across these various asset classes that all use the LP secondary framework and the GP-led secondary framework. And that's just creating more and more supply in the marketplace and more specialists in terms of funds on the demand side. So I think we can pretty comfortably say that the market will continue to grow exponentially over the next, whether it be 5 years or 10 years.
Yeah, and thinking about its broader role within the private markets ecosystem and the broader financial markets. I mean, we're talking about, you know, all these different asset classes. You mentioned credit, infrastructure, real estate, that there are others as well. The comparison with the IPO market in terms of size for exits, it sounds like what we're describing is a capital market in its own right. Would you agree with that? I mean, what role do you think it will play in the future within that broader ecosystem?
You know, I think we've made the point that, and we are fully in the tank for the secondary market. I mean, Paul's point about it being larger than the IPO market for the last 3 years, I believe that the secondary market was 3 times larger than the IPO market last year, 3 times. And we continue to forecast its growth. If you look across other capital markets, it was larger, I believe, than every other so-called market than growth capital. There was probably more investment in growth capital last year because of the data center and AI boom than there was liquidity provided in the secondary market. But a market of that size doesn't go away. It's not a flash in the pan. We had heard some years ago that what was happening in the secondary market could mimic the SPAC market. We thought about it and then dismissed that, because the secondary market is a structural change, a necessity for the private markets, for this explosion, as Paul said, in partnerships across all asset types. So we think it will be a linchpin, not just a participant, but a linchpin to the capital markets going forward.
Yeah, and think about this, Tom. I mean, as we all know, or most people know, maybe some on this call won't know, but you know, the public markets are shrinking, right? Just talk about corporates, right? There's less companies that are public now than there have ever been. Those private markets, which are often owned by private equity inside of these funds, they will need liquidity, or they will need growth capital, because we know you can provide growth capital through these transactions. So it has to be an integral part of the overall capital markets. I mean, think about a private equity sponsor. They do 3 things. They buy companies, they hopefully make them better, and then they sell them. So the third element, the key cornerstone of their business, selling them, is all about exit management. What am I going to do with this company? And the GP-led solution, as an example, is such a core integral component of, should I sell it to another sponsor? Should I sell it to strategic? Should I sell it to an IPO? Or should I continue to own it through a continuation vehicle? So it has become so embedded in the way sponsors think. Here's a good stat for you. Recently, the stats came out that 80% of the top 100 private market managers by AUM have done a CV or multiple CVs. 80%. That is how embedded secondaries has become in the capital markets.
Well, thanks, Paul. Thanks, Jeff. It's been a pleasure to have you on today.
That was Jeff Hammer and Paul Sanabria, who are managing directors at Moelis & Company, speaking to Merger Markets Funds editor Tom Kane. And just to point out, we're recording this on Friday, the 30th of January. Thanks for listening to this episode of Dealcast. For more information, please have a look at our show notes. Join us again next week.